History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you're asked what the most important books were in American history, you could hardly be blamed if you, off the top of your head, chose things like the Bible or the classical works that made up the core reading list for the founding fathers, like Virgil, Horace, Tacitus, Thucydides, or Plato. But according to one journalist, a canon of 13 simple best-selling self-help books, from the Old Farmer's Almanac from the 1700s to Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, are what may have established the archetype of the ideal American. The self-made entrepreneur or the optimist who sees through any challenge that comes his way. Today's guest is journalist Jess McHugh. She explores the history of 13 of America's most popular books, chronologically tracing their origins, in her book Americanon, an unexpected U.S. history in 13 best-selling books. From educational texts like Webster's Speller and Dictionary and the McGuffey Readers, to domestic guides such as Emily Post's Etiquette and the Betty Crocker Cookbook, to motivational and self-help classics like How to Win Friends and Influence People and the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, these texts, many of which have sold tens of millions of copies, are the books that have subconsciously come to define what it means to be American. So if you've heard business cliches like synergy or think outside the box, it comes from books like these. They've continued to shape generation after generation and reinforce which ideals we should fight to uphold, and encouraged a uniquely American brand of nationalism that some argue is all often too weaponized and may shut down new ideas. So this looks at a history of ideas and perhaps a chance to audit some of the things that have entered the collective consciousness and maybe need to be challenged. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Jess McHugh. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's really interesting looking at the books on your list and the ideas that they've introduced, how they're so taken for granted, the American consciousness. It's almost surprising they're traceable to one book. And a very short story that underlines this. When I was in college in the early 2000s, I was an engineer for my first couple of years before I had to change majors because it was too hard. And one of my professors in his early 60s showed us a video where he introduced to us the groundbreaking idea of think outside the box and change your paradigms. And when the guy in the video first wrote on the screen, think outside the box, the class, which were just 18, 19-year-old engineers, broke out in mock applause as if, oh, wow, like the think outside the box. So this was a cliched idea in the early 2000s, but I wonder, was this idea by Stephen Covey just groundbreaking in the 80s and the other ideas in your books that you've listed when they first came out?
Yes, I think it really was. And Stephen Covey is a great example of so much of the kind of lingua franca of business that we kind of take for granted now. Much of it can be traced back to Stephen Covey, like win-win, for instance, or paradigm shift. A lot of these kind of slang kind of expressions. And what is fascinating is that if you read, or I've read so many of the reviews of just kind of average readers of Stephen Covey's book, and there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these 5-star reviews saying this book completely changed my life, it completely revolutionized the way that I work or am with my family. So I think especially when it's the first of its kind of book, Stephen Covey certainly had precursors, whether they be Ben Franklin or even Dale Carnegie, but he's really putting it into terms for his specific generation in a way that very much resonated.
Well, what I think is interesting about your book is it intersects two different educational streams I've done. One is the reading of history, but on the other side, just learning how to have a podcast and do digital marketing. I realize that ideas that I'm presented with are just third or fourth generation facsimiles of something that Ben Franklin said in the 1750s or the 1760s. And maybe we could start with Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. I know it's not the first on your list, but some of the things he's done, like have his 13 vices, his list that he wants to conquer over the course of his life, which I've mentioned on the show, are things that modern day Stoics or podcasters or bloggers will talk about. But yeah, tell me about his autobiography at first and ideas he introduced into the American consciousness and how maybe it's not quite as clear cut as he presents himself.
Sure. I think that's a great place to start, because in many ways, you could argue that Franklin is kind of the first self-help book in America. And he's laying out this blueprint, and as you said, kind of self-improvement. And so he has these 13 virtues that he wants to kind of better himself with every day. And the idea is that little by little, if you work on it, you will improve. And what I also kind of find interesting and a little bit funny about him is that he's kind of at once selling himself and selling the idea that is America. So he's retelling his story, but he's also retelling what he hopes will be kind of the Prometheus of America, this kind of classless self-made man. And that's certainly a trope that gets picked up kind of again and again.
I'm curious, what is it about certain books that manage to succeed wildly? Because in one sense, there's nothing terribly remarkable about them. They're a list of etiquette or manners or primers. This is kind of a well-worn genre. But things like The Old Farmer's Almanac, that could, at its most prosaic level, just be weather reports. But then it's sprinkled, of course, with much more. Or Webster's English Dictionary. Again, it's a dictionary. It seemed dry as a technical manual for a Lego set. So what is it about these books that happen to capture the imagination of the young republic?
Right. It's a great question. I think it's a mix of a lot of things. I think it's kind of a right time, right place type of situation. A lot of the time, I think these people were hitting on an element of American belief or American culture that people wanted to or liked to believe about themselves, whether it be the power of the small farmer or kind of the self-made man, or for Webster, for instance, it was this notion that we could have a new, better culture than Britain, based on our language. At the same time, many of these people were very savvy, almost kind of PR expert type people. Webster is a good example. Franklin is a good example, where part of their success has to be attributed to the fact that they were determined for their books to succeed. So Webster, for instance, went on what was described as the first American book tour. And he goes around trotting on these carriages and he breaks his leg falling off a horse, but he's really hawking his book city by city. And I think that has to, you know, be taken into consideration when you look at the fact that his speller sold 100 million copies.
And another thing, too, as you delve into the personalities and quirks and biases of the authors of these texts, are there any anecdotes about them that stuck out to you or surprised you?
Sure. I mean, there are so many. The quirks are kind of unending. I think Dale Carnegie is a great example, where I had associated him with a certain type of MBA or people who want to be CEOs. And I was so surprised to learn that he had grown up at the turn of the 20th century in this very rural area of Missouri. His family was indebted on this small family farm. They had to burn their pigs because they died of cholera every year. It was a pretty kind of grim growing up. And even his young adulthood, he would commute to college on horseback because his parents couldn't afford the $1 a year room and board. So I think when you have that understanding of him, it makes his book be understood in such a different light, where I think I see it as someone who was born of lack and desperation, trying to survive, rather than someone who's really trying to manipulate.
Right. And I think that's a good point, too, because there are cliches that come out of many of these books. And I think there's definitely critiques to be made of these authors. But compared to other things that have come out that are straight up snake oil, like The Secret, where basically like the reason that bad things happen to you is because you don't think positively, which, you know, tell that to people starving in sub-Saharan Africa, or Napoleon Hill, Think and Grow Rich. I love how he has anecdotes in his book that are demonstrably false, like claiming that he happened to be in the White House with Woodrow Wilson when he was trying to negotiate the Treaty of Paris or the Treaty of Versailles, and just had his head buried in his hand saying, oh, what am I going to do? So basically, Napoleon Hill makes it out like he's personally consulting Wilson on how to create the post-World War I order. But at the very least, let's give these authors credit that they're not that. So
yeah, it depends. I mean, I think some of them certainly had their prejudices. I think of Catherine Beecher, for instance. She writes these books that are ostensibly about taking care of the home and about cooking. And she's quite explicit in a lot of her writings that she worries about what she calls the hordes of the illiterate, who are Catholic immigrants coming from places like Germany and Ireland. And she really fears that they're going to kind of pollute pollute the Protestant soul of America. And part of safeguarding what she sees as the nation's identity is by making sure that the American home becomes this kind of bastion of American values. So it kind of varies author to author.
Yeah, and I'm curious, there's a number of etiquette books on your list. So that's one you mentioned by Catherine Beecher, written in 1841. And then another one is written by Emily Post in 1922, Etiquette in Society and Business and Politics and at Home. These particular etiquette books, why do you think they were so popular? And what does it say about the time of about the times in which they were written, the types of manners that they're telling people to have?
Yes, definitely. I think Emily Post is an interesting example because her book comes out in 1922 in mid the roaring 20s at a time when people think manners are going out the window. But in fact, what you see that is that if people want to make it in America, and her book was marketed not just toward women, but toward kind of up and coming businessmen, that you need to know the rules. And so as she says in kind of the introduction to her book in this very American democratic way, it doesn't matter where you're born or to whom. If you know the rules, you can have access to the highest institutions, which is in many ways a flawed promise, but it's certainly an attractive promise. And I think it speaks to this moment of wealth and prosperity in the early 20th century when people feel like they can get in on the ground floor.
Another thing too, I suppose this is maybe looking at this from a more historical lens, but I've heard of scholars of the Victorian era that it's interesting that there was a sort of a mania about sexual propriety at a time when propriety was almost never cranked as high as it was in terms of manners and having skirts over table legs to not, you know, mimic the female leg form, whatever. So it's almost like a photo negative that the thing that society was concerned about were things that really weren't a troubling aspect of society, which is perhaps that blind spot that made other things troublesome. So I don't know if that's accurate, or I wouldn't say that's a universal rule by any means, but do you think you ever came across things like that where they're really stressing some type of action or value or way to behave that's proper that you think, well, it's not that they were so concerned about that because they were almost obsessed to it that they couldn't help but do that?
Yes, I think that plays into it quite a lot. And I think often, especially with the kind of domestic guides, it tends to be holding on to a vision of America that's already changing. So when the Beecher sisters write their second book in 1869, you already have people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton who are saying, no, we don't need to stay home. And so it already is kind of a vestige. At the same time, kind of as you mentioned, sometimes these books do, similar to the way that you see kind of the Victorian era, they come out of a reaction to a fear of kind of chaos or change. And so the book is kind of preemptively trying to put people in their place or order the world in a way, especially if we're talking about periods of war or kind of economic upheaval. And we see that a lot of these bestsellers follow after things like the Civil War, the Great Depression, the World Wars.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Getting into the more modern era, let's jump to 1984, You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. And it's kind of like the rise of soft New Age literature. And I remember kind of like the tail end of this, there was the satanic panic scares that kids were going to get into ritual suicide by playing Dungeons and Dragons and things of that like, which obvious there's one connection. So how is she riding a wave that was popularized by something else or talk about this phenomenon in American history, because I had actually not heard of this book. So I don't know what that says about me or if perhaps the popularity of this was ephemeral, but can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, it was a book that I had not been familiar with myself, but again, was a huge bestseller, I think upwards of 40 million copies. And what is kind of wild is that she was part of a much broader wave of kind of New Age thinkers in the late 70s and 80s that also sold tens of millions of copies. And I think what she's hitting on was both a product of the 70s and 80s, which is to say kind of more of an interest in Eastern spirituality or what people perceive to be Eastern spirituality, and also some of the precarity of that time. I think we can project the kind of rose-colored glasses onto the prosperity of the 1980s, but for a lot of middle-class and working working class people. There was, you know, mass layoffs and a fair amount of uncertainty. So I think this idea that's really prevalent in the New Age is that you can control the universe through your thoughts to a certain extent, and you can attract good things to you by the way that you think, which proved to be very, very attractive to so many people and very popular. And what also surprised me was to see that in some ways, there are certain scholars of religion who have argued that the roots of the New Age come out of much older spiritual practices, alternative spiritual practices in America, such as Christian Science, such as Swedenborgianism and spiritualism even. So I think that kind of mix of the old and the new was playing into the popularity of that book.
That's a really interesting point, because people think that this type of spiritualism came because the Beatles decided to start meditating in the 1960s. So it was a direct import from India and elsewhere. But actually, there are native phenomena like this, the spiritualism or things that led to seances in the late 19th, early 20th centuries that can kind of be a take on this. And the other aspect, too, kind of like the moralism and the Puritanism that's divorced from its original roots. You have an interesting description of Stephen Covey's book, where you trace his staunch Mormon convictions into a moral recipe for success. And this leads to his phrases like synergy and paradigm shift and other things, launching the management self-help industry. So yeah, talk about that, just because I think if there's perhaps any one book where we're still like much in like the after effects of, that would be a book.
Oh, certainly. I think, yeah, so much of our present notions about working and about success are Coveyisms to a certain extent. And what's fascinating to me about him is that he is this mix, I would say, of kind of ecclesiastical Christian views, so to speak. And he's also fused with what he called success literature. So he was a huge fan of Benjamin Franklin, and he got this doctorate studying these essentially self-help books over the course of American history. And so his notion was that in order to succeed, we need to have moral leadership in America. And I think part of what he was reacting to was kind of a perceived lack of that. And so I think part of also what made his book so attractive to people is he's essentially saying everybody can be a leader in their own right, whether it's in their community, whether it's in their family, whether it's in their business. And this book is a way to get you there.
And part of the reason you call your book Americanon is the idea of a canon, term that the classicist Mortimer J. Adler called the Great Conversation, in that the writers who produced the great texts had read the others before them and were all in dialogue with one another. And what you're doing is drawing a line that connects these influential texts, and these authors are influenced by those that came before them, and they shape those that come after them. So do you see the influence of these authors on some influential figures in America today, like big tech figures or CEOs or political leaders or others?
Hugely. I think, as you mentioned, so many of the books within my book build on each other. So somebody like Stephen Covey, who was looking at Benjamin Franklin, and Dale Carnegie was also looking at Benjamin Franklin. And I think what's interesting now is that you do see so many leaders today referring back to these same texts. It surprised me to learn that Elon Musk was also a huge Benjamin Franklin fan and a fan of the autobiography, because his brand, to me, his personal brand, seems so thoroughly 21st century. I was surprised to learn that he was a fan of this 18th century founding father. Another example that I note in the book is that I think, as we both pointed out, not everyone is familiar with New Age thinking, but New Age thinking has deeply shaped so many of our present figures. And I think about Donald Trump, who his pastor was Norman Vincent Peale, who was one of the kind of influences on Louise Hay and was also a best-selling New Age thinker. And I think when you think about the notion of New Age as kind of this unfailing belief in the self that doesn't take into account any sort of outside input, in some ways it can offer a kind of poignant view into Donald Trump's mindset.
And I'd like to combine the past and the present here. And I suppose we're talking very broadly about the self-help industry. And this is something that I have encountered a lot just in my own self-education on things like digital marketing. Often you're not just reading a blog post on how to do search engine optimization or how to write good content. Then the author will start to spiel into mentioning these self-help authors, and then you just get sucked down the rabbit hole. So I've intentionally or unintentionally spent a lot of time with these people and these ideas, and it is just like, it is a scammy black hole and is crazy how it gets. So what is your take on the origins and the rise of the self-help industry and your views on it? And did your research alter your perspective on it?
Sure. I think my research certainly did alter my perspective on it, because when I started off, I was very skeptical of self-help as a genre. And to a certain extent, I still am, but I really saw it as nothing but snake oil salesmen. And that certainly is an aspect of it. But what I came to appreciate about self-help is that it's so much faster than that. And a lot of it does embody so much of kind of the kind of upstart side of America. And I write a little bit about my maternal grandfather in this book, who was such a huge fan of Dale Carnegie and of so many of these other books. But for him, it was really part of his own spiritual, intellectual renewal. He wasn't trying to scam anybody. He kind of read it like he read the big book. He was just trying to make himself a better person. And I think there's real value in it when self-help is used, not as a tool of manipulation or necessarily of money-making, but as a way to kind of turn inward. And I think that's the best of what it can offer. And I think the worst of what it can offer is also quite clear.
Right. And so I guess as a final question, kind of a grab bag about what you see as being good and bad about this genre, because when I was seeing your list, I was thinking, if you write a second edition, who would be the 21st century person? And let me tell you what I guess, but then I want to hear what you think. I thought maybe Tim Ferriss, author of The 4-Hour Workweek, who the book is really all about how in our hypersaturated information economy, how do you quickly get to the heart of things? And how do you, the critics would say, basically grab the badges of success and the titles that indicate you're successful while doing as minimum actual work as possible? And the ultimate dark side of this would be like stolen valor, where people wear soldier uniforms without having actually served, or Steve Jobs, not the person, but in the brilliant TV series Silicon Valley, there's a Steve Jobs stand-in where they take all of his sociopathic tendencies and the character, he's basically constantly trying to destroy other people around him, a total sociopath, but he's using the language of making the world a better place. But he says multiple times, no one can make the world a better place before me. And so there's the facade of Buddhism and mindfulness and namaste, but underneath of it, total Machiavellian cutthroat. Anyway, so I guess to cap this off, who would you add to this list in the 21st century? And overall, like, what do you see as like the light side and dark side of this canon?
Definitely. So I think there are so many that could be added. The thing that's difficult about talking about what could be added to the canon now is that because there are so many more books being published by such a broader range of writers, which is a great thing, I think you're seeing less the phenomenon of everybody in America, 100 million people buying the same book. Although I will say, I agree. I think it would be, if we have to choose, it would be in the kind of Tim Ferriss genre. I know she's not American, but Marie Kondo, I think, has some things to say about our kind of moment in time, Oprah even. And the more dark side, I would say things like Rachel Hollis and Girl Wash Your Face and the kind of girl boss type of literature. So along those same lines, I think what is good about it is that, like I had said before, this notion that you don't need to have an interlocutor for your own kind of self-discovery. You don't need a priest or another person telling you what to think. At its best, if you really take self-help to kind of go on your own journey of discovery about what it is that you want and how to get that, or if it helps you get a promotion, I think all of that can be great. What can be bad, as we've mentioned, is sort of the manipulation or the snake oily aspect of it. I also think what can be a little bit dark about it is what can also be dark about some of these other books, this notion that if the only thing standing between you and more, or the only thing standing between you and success, is your behavior, then it really makes everyone so culpable in a way that doesn't take into account generational poverty or racism or sexism or any of the other reasons that people might struggle to succeed. So I hope that this book, among other things, will kind of nuance some of those stories about what it means to be self-made and who gets to make it in America.
All right. Well, there's a lot more to unpack from this book. And for listeners who want to check it out, the book is Americanon, an Unexpected U.S. History in 13 Best-Selling Books. Jess, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. I've been listening to your podcast for years, so it's been a real thrill.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.